listening to a 9to5.cc podcast.
Hey everyone, just a quick reminder that if you're going to be making any purchases on Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, or Zazzle.com, please go to www.9to5.cc first and click the links in the sidebar or at the bottom of the page to support the site. It makes no difference to you, but it really helps us out a lot. Enjoy the show. Thanks.
Go plug yourself.
Weird take on the glory hole question.
We touched on glory holes.
Led to some clown sex.
Clown fucking.
But because the previous guest was a fetish piercer.
The last guest was not a fetish piercer.
The guest before the last guest.
Right, that happened.
My God.
Yeah.
I've won in a long, illustrious line. I'm inadequate now.
This is the trifecta. You're cranning the trifecta here. Are we going?
Yeah, this is definitely recording. This is Go Plug Yourself. And I said last week, or last episode, that episode, that was 25. That was 24. This is our silver episode.
Yay.
This is episode 25.
Episode 25.
Fantastic. Silver anniversary.
And our guest on this illustrious occasion is a heavily perspiring Richard... (Bugs) Burnett, how are you?
Just came back from a marathon.
I'm shivitzing like a motherfucker. Holy mackerel, but the beer is cold, so it's all good.
You made the same mistake as Montrealers everywhere for the past 2 days. You leave with a scarf and mittens and a big coat, and you're like, it's December. And then you're like, what the fuck, 15 degrees. You're like, this is in the trunk of my car is like my coat and like everything. Just fucking.
You got to put it in your trunk,
My trunk smells like shit right
now. Now, Richard was so kind to do it. Was so kind to do an impromptu pre-interview before we headed into this, which is interesting because we usually just sort of fly by the seat of our pants here, and touched on a lot of anecdotes that we couldn't get into here. Before we do any of that, I don't know this. I don't know you as well as I think a lot of people in Montreal do. I've only got to meet you about a year and a half ago, maybe like not even like
yeah.
Anyway, the Bugs thing. What's that from?
Well, I used to have buck teeth when I was a kid and through high school.
Okay.
So they used to call me Bugs Bunny or, you know, all that kind of stuff. Then I got braces, and then I wrote a column. It was, I guess, I started working at Hour Magazine in May of 95, and one of my first columns, $3 bill columns, I wrote was how Bugs Bunny was a graduate of the Milton Berle School of Burlesque.
Right.
And so we slugged it on the cover of the newspaper as by Bugs Buggery Burnett. And ever since then, everybody's called me Bugs all
Buggery
over again.
Burnett.
Yeah.
That's
Bugs Buggery Burnett.
Bugs Buggery.
I like it.
Hilarious.
Okay, so that's...
It's a different time in fucking local newspapers. But A, they existed, and B, apparently they could print anything.
I know. It's like we're talking about the Jurassic era, man, you know?
Yeah. Well, no, but even just like fucking... I remember when I like got word of the Mirror shutting down... Went back and like looked at the archives before they were also mysteriously taken down.
Yeah.
Which, because Hour, if I'm not mistaken, still online.
They're still up.
But the Mirror just disappeared.
Yeah.
No, but I think they've since had their archives put up though.
Have they?
Since that, I think you could get them now.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Doesn't matter.
Either way, it doesn't matter. But just reading back old issues, there just seemed to be a lot more like interesting shit going on in both of them, like than what I remember the like what they sort of kind of ended up becoming. Like, there was, like, obviously, like, your column and, like, some of the columns were still good, but the overall, like, the movie reviews were just, like, bland movie reviews.
The papers had changed and had gone into decline for many years. I'll tell you, the Montreal Mirror, I know that the publisher of Hour and Voir had wanted initially to buy the Montreal Mirror, and they refused to sell. So he started up his own paper, and, of course, it became a classic newspaper war. And at the end, before Hour folded, I would say before really the recession hit, I mean, the Montreal Mirror was losing thousands and thousands of dollars. I would estimate probably in a neighborhood of anywhere between 20 and 25, maybe more, per week.
Jesus.
Wow.
And basically, they would not sell ads. Everybody knew, and everybody in town would know, you would only go to the Mirror at the very, very last minute, because then they'd have like a fire sale for their ads, because they just had to fill up the paper. But Quebecor kept funding and subsidizing this thing because they wanted to, I think, personally, they wanted to drive Hour out of business. Hour folded as the original Hour in April 7th. The last issue was April 7th, 2011.
Yeah.
And then they renamed it Hour Community so that they could get rid of everybody without getting sued, right, for wrongful dismissal.
Right.
And then when that our community then survived for about another year or so, and it folded in May of 2012.
Okay.
And then the Montreal Mirror folded within 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
So the minute Hour was gone, there was absolutely no reason for Quebecor to keep the Mirror open. And it's really sad. I always hate to see Anglo-Montreal journalists out of work, but they absolutely lost all of their leverage, all the Mirror staffers, the minute Hour went under.
Yeah.
And there was absolutely no reason for Quebecor to keep them open anymore.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. And it was a very sad day, not just for Anglo journalists, but for Anglo culture and alternative culture.
Yeah,
particularly alternative culture. A lot of the stuff that the three of us here enjoy, like to go see, a lot of the stuff is just flying under the radar in the city now because they're not getting the coverage, at least in print media.
Yeah, I remembered, I grew up in Rosemere, so like a 40-minute train ride out kind of thing. And I remember grade 11, so when you're like 15, 16 and stuff, like, when someone, like, went to the city and, like, brought back an Hour or a Mirror, like, and it got passed around and stuff like that, because, like, we were, like, kind of, like, skateboard wannabe punk kids or whatever else like that, but you didn't have a stand for it. So it would be, like, someone would come back and pass it around, and I was like, that is completely non-existent anymore. I mean, I guess there's the internet, but it's still, like, there's a different vibe, I think, of, like, physically passing around.
You know, I got to tell you, speaking about reading newspapers, this is what I love about reading newspapers. I used to love reading the Sunday New York Times on Sunday afternoons at Elsa's Bar out in the Plateau. And I'd sit at the bar, and all I'd do all afternoon while reading the newspaper, I'd be sitting next to my mentor, Nick Offdemar, the late Nick Offdemar, and we'd grunt at each other while doing shots of tequila with Elsa at the bar. We would talk to each other all afternoon. We'd just sit there doing shots and reading the paper. That was one of the great pleasures of reading print. And incidentally, this venue is where I met Nick for the first time.
And let's remind listeners that we do this podcast regularly out of the back room of Grumpy's.
Yes.
Where apparently Nick still has a tab. Yeah.
There's such like a mixed reaction that we do it out of Grumpy's. Like someone apparently, was it John? Last week, John was like, they didn't let me in here because I was wearing a hat. And I was like, what fucking night of what fucking year were you refused admittance to Grumpy's because of your hat? I was like, how did this fucking happen? And fucking, who else was
I don't know.
Sammy? Sammy had never stepped in foot. Sugar Sammy had never stepped foot here, which, like, to me, blew my fucking mind.
Yeah.
I was like, really? I'm like, you're such a been around Montreal all the time.
How did you get? How did you come to know?
And you met him here.
How Nick did Offerman. I? How did I come here?
Or to know Nick?
It was after I started work at Hour, and I don't know what happened, but for some reason, a bunch of us, there were what we called the Three Musketeers. It was Lyle Stewart, who came over from the Montreal Mirror, Jamie O'Meara, who started off with Hour, and I was actually a reporter over at the Nuns Island Magazine, a community newspaper, and I was doing the police blotter, and I was it was a bilingual paper, so I'd be translating stories one way to the other. I was doing sports stories, the police blotter. Anyway, the old editor in chief over there, Peter Wieland, was the news editor at Hour, so he let me put my foot in the door. I always give my props to Peter because he really is the one I feel that helped launch me in the world of journalism. And so between Jamie, Lyle, and myself, we would do like our monthly pilgrimage, to Crescent Street. We were Plateau Boys, but anyway, one particular night we popped into this joint, and who's holding court at the bar but Nick Offdemar. Nick and I just from that point on, we just got along like
two peas in a pod.
Two peas in a pod, man. I mean, I remember, right in front of the fireplace here, they used to have like a little living room with armchairs and stuff.
Yeah,
I remember, waking Nick up. I won't tell you what time it was, but it was really, really late. And, hey, Nick, we got to go home, man, man. He was a really, really decent human being, and I miss him a lot.
Did you ever have any run-ins with Mr. Richler?
No, yes and no. He used to host the Parizeau Awards up at Carina's on the third floor of the Sir Winston complex.
Right.
And so that only lasted 2 or 3 years, but the Parizeau Award was given out to,
To an English Quebecer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he would stand there and he'd shake everybody's hand. He paid for everything. Mr. Richler paid for everything. He paid everybody's tab. It was food, booze, you name it, and as much as you wanted. And so, of course, on your way in, you go, hello, Mr. Richler, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't actually know him, per se. But I do remember sometime, I guess it was the late 90s, he had a column in the National Post. And at that point, Hour had caught up with the mirror and the page count. We actually had caught up, and we were kind of neck and neck at one stage. And he wrote a column about comparing the two different papers. And, of course, he came across my column, $3 Bill. And my column that week, or the week prior, was about the National Lesbian Gay Journalists Association. I was the founding president of the Montreal chapter. And Mordecai writes, well, I guess this is the time for this organization has come, but unfortunately it's not an organization that will welcome me and my kind. So, of course, the brass out in T.O. in Washington, D.C., after they got a wind of this and how you critique my column, we gave him a lifetime membership.
And did he accept? Did he gladly accept?
Yeah.
Oh. What the hell were we talking about?
Nick Offermeyer. Nick Offermeyer.
Yeah,
Yeah,
so that's great. Because like I was saying, that we've never actually had a guest on who I think really truly appreciates the history of the room.
Yeah.
Or the...
Nick was, he was a hell of a drinker. He always had his little suitcase, and he carried stuff around with him that he had in there for years and years. Clippings, his favorite photographs. And... actually, in fact, it reminds me a lot of Michael Musto, the gossip columnist with the Village Voice in New York. He's always walking around with his little, you know, little suitcase kind of thing as well. Love Michael, but Nick, special guy, and I remember one time, he was the godfather of Mordecai's son Jake.
Really? Okay.
And Jake is the reason why I never ended up working at the Montreal Mirror.
I interviewed him a few weeks ago. Actually.
Oh, right on, Beth. Yeah. Jacob was a big Montreal Expos fan, I guess, and so was I. And in 1994, when the player strike took away what should have been our pennant run World Series season, I pitched to Montreal Mirror. At that point, I had not started at Hour, and I had pitched an Expos story to the Montreal Mirror, and I said, every time the Expos look like they're going postseason, there's a freaking player strike. So I got assigned the piece, and of course, Jake wanted to write it. And so then I got a sheepish phone call from the news editor there at the time saying, well, we'll give you a $50 kill fee. Jake wants to write the piece. Fine, whatever it is. But unfortunately, the same routine, not with Jake, but with the same news editor, happened twice more. And after three times, I said, fuck this shit. I'm going to go start pitching to the Hour. And that's how Peter Whelan over there brought me in.
You don't know.
That would have – just sorry. Does that focus on 1994? Well, that would have been – probably like the most amazing thing in the world. If we won Stanley Cup in 93 and the World Series in 94, the city would have been like...
Would have been great.
Just coming down from the party in 2012.
We'd still have a baseball team.
We would definitely still have a baseball team. But it just like... I remember the vibe was like insane when we were winning. And then like... Because of the player strike, I remember announced like a couple months before the end of the season. And like as a kid, me not really understanding that it was actually going to happen because I was like... 11 or 12, I guess, at the time, and I was like, oh, they'll sort it out, like, and then it happened, and I was like, and we finished first, and I was like, what the fuck is that good for? Like,
you know, and that's kind of what, oh, go ahead, finish this.
Yeah, no, it was just, like, as a kid, I was like, we won the Stanley Cup, and it just makes sense that we win the fucking World Series the next year.
You know, the 1994 Expos season, that whole baseball season started, the Major League Baseball did not have a contract with the players.
Yeah.
And the players' rep, the union rep, was actually Donald Fehr, the guy who's repping the NHLPA this year.
Really?
And so what happened was he said, the players' union said, listen, man, we'll go to work this season. We won't go on strike, blah, 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 blah. We'll negotiate in good faith throughout the season. But, of course, you know, that didn't happen. And so ever since then, you'll see none of the sports leagues do that mistake, and especially with Donald Fehr, of course, who was repping the NHL.
Because supposedly that was something they put on the table, right? This year with the hockey strike, was that they will play, and whatever agreement comes to,
but you know
will be backdated in.
Yeah, but would you trust Donald Fehr? I would.
Exactly. You know? But then you're sort of like, remember
not
that time?
Not in this situation.
Remember that time with baseball? And you're like, oh.
I just want to ask real quick. You got into all this the community journalism and whatnot, and did you have any kind of like formal training in the field, or was it just sort of? Because like I know I mean the concept of having formal training in journalism is still a relatively new concept. Like I have a BA, in journalism for all that's worth.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I that is a disparaging remark, I am sure, and I could not agree with you more. I got to tell you, when I get invited to talk to journalism students, by the time they're actually journalism students, I try to, you know, encourage them. I say, if you're here to you know, become really, really famous or make $1 million, you're in the wrong business. Usually when I speak to people who want to go into journalism before they actually enroll, I actually try to encourage them to take a degree in something else. I believe you cannot teach curiosity. You can't teach somebody to ask a question. I think you just need a basic few core courses that teach you the how not to get sued, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
How to put the inverted pyramid lead together or whatever it is. But other than that, I don't think it warrants 3 years. And I think students
shedding
are
a tear right now.
No, I'm not. I had a good 3 years. It was fun. I mean, I went to Denmark and stuff. So anyway.
Yeah. I think people are better. I think students are better served by having doing a major, minor in politics and history, getting a base of knowledge in some kind of subject that they can write about, and then maybe going for a certificate in journalism.
Yeah.
I think anything, I have half my credits towards a joint specialization in English and history, and I'm like, those are both, I think any sort of essay-heavy subject is going to, like, I guess, help you to be a writer, because your essays have to fucking make sense. And like you said, if you have that curiosity, you could probably,
you know, I mean, you can teach people how to tweak, but I think generally speaking, people know how to write or you don't know how to write. It's kind of like people, when you take a picture, you either have an eye or you don't have an eye. I think it's basically the same thing with journalism. Unfortunately, the business is full of hacks. And there's a lot of really bad writers and a lot of bad researchers and stuff like that. But, you know, it's the nature of the game. It's just like in any other business. I mean, there's a lot of crap everywhere, you know?
Well, fuck, it was always, whenever I go back to, like, the state of, like, journalism and newspapers and magazines and all that stuff. Remember, did you come with us to Lake George the year where I picked up the Playboys from the 60s?
Yes.
The, like, long form articles in Playboy were just, like, page after page of text.
Yeah.
From, like, noted writers of the time and stuff like that. And you're like, first of all, like, at least from a modern perspective, you wouldn't expect to see that in Playboy. Yeah. But you don't see that in any magazine anymore.
It's really difficult to find long reads now. But, you know, those are fun reads. I think people don't even have the attention span for that anymore, quite frankly.
I read a Tarantino. There was a recent Tarantino interview in a recent Playboy, like last issue, I think in the November Playboy. And I was reading it online, and it was like, okay, turn page for the next part of the, and I assumed it was going to be, you know, page 2 of 10,
right?
And it was page 2 of 2. Oof. And then it was the interview was over. And I was like, this is what, just like, it was a decent piece, but
they're just short.
My favorite magazine these days is actually Vanity Fair. They still pen long pieces,
really,
know?
Still
yeah
once you get past page 50 of ads,
Vanity
Fair freaks me out when you pick it up and it's like, and you're looking for the goddamn table of contents and it's on page 49, right. You know, like,
and then the second half of the contents is page 72.
Yeah
fuck the stores. New Yorker still does pretty long ads occasionally. Vice.
Well, and New York Magazine right now, they got Frank Rich, who used to be the writer over at the New York Times, but he's been over now at New York Magazine for about 6 months, maybe a year, and he's a great writer.
My reading of the New Yorker always, like, spikes around election time, just to get, like, sort of an opinion column, which doesn't seem, it's obviously, like, a slightly skewed opinion. They have, like, their own agenda, but it's not super crazy opinion. Like, I find getting opinion on American elections that's even close to still being news is,
I just want to say, for the sake of posterity, for the whole body of these various episodes of the podcast, that Keith's saying my reading of the New Yorker usually spikes around election time is the single most pretentious thing you've ever said. Like, the rest of the year, you're just reading it casually, like, just sitting on top of your toilet, you know? It's like, leaping through it.
I'll flip through the headlines.
Like, my reading of the New Yorker spikes around election time. That's amazing.
It depends, but it's true.
It's like my reading of Blue Boy spikes when I get a hard-on.
But it's the same way that I watch a lot more Jon Stewart around election times. Like,
that one I believe.
You say I don't read the New Yorker, you son of a bitch.
Now, Richard, born and raised?
Yeah, born and raised in Montreal. My father is British, and his father actually was a firefighter in London during the Blitz.
That's it.
He's a firefighter in London. And actually, one of my favorite stories of his is his father, my grandfather, the firefighter, comes home from a shift and finds my dad, his son, playing with an unexploded German incendiary bomb in the backyard. And he's like, what the fuck are you doing? My mom is from Mauritius.
You were very close to never being.
Yeah, totally, too. Big time. And on both sides, as a matter of fact, because on my mom's side, her father was Félix Laventure, and he was a politician in Mauritius, which is a dot of an island in southern Africa, around Madagascar, South Africa.
Okay.
And that was it was still a British colony. I'm good. Yeah, man.
Just have a beer.
We love booze.
All right.
So, well, we can keep going here, right? Everything's
fine. Yeah. No, don't edit.
Okay. So he was a Cambridge-educated lawyer, and he took on a lot of cases helping out the poor. And eventually he became the mayor of the capital city of Mauritius, Port Louis.
Okay.
And that's when he became a real thorn in the side of the British. My family, my Mauritian family is mixed. Brown, white, and black. When the British outlawed slavery in Mauritius in 1833, you couldn't bring blacks as slaves to work the sugar plantations from the mainland. So what they did is they brought in indentured laborers from India. One of those indentured laborers from Madras, my family, Laventure, used to own a sugar plantation in Mauritius.
Okay.
And he was a Frenchman, Mr. Laventure, and he fell in love with this woman from Madras, this indentured laborer. That's how my family tree on that side started. And by the time my grandfather became the mayor of Port Louis, here was a brown man supporting all these brown and black people against the British. So they said, this guy's a pain in the butt. So they actually said, okay, well, better to have him on our side. So they appointed him a government minister. And he ended up hosting a Commonwealth conference that was talking about introducing farming co-ops for the poor. After the conference, he introduced a bill in the Mauritian Parliament that would expropriate land from all the British landowners and turn their sugar plantations into farming co-ops for the poor.
Okay.
The shit hit the fucking fan, as you can imagine.
The English don't like people taking their money or their livelihoods. Well, not their livelihoods. Their extra money.
Yeah. The shit hit the fan. And basically then the Governor General of Mauritius at the time was Sir Hilary Blood. And he and my grandfather absolutely hated each other's guts. But the orders came from above. Offer him the ambassadorship to Washington, D.C. Get him out of the country. We want him gone. Of course, my grandfather refused it. He said, there's no way I'm going. I'm going to see this through. And so they froze all the properties and all that shit, and they exiled the family. And we ended up coming to Montreal because we still wanted to live in French. And I went back to Mauritius most recently a few years ago with my mom. And the old family sugar plantation is now a town called Laventure after my grandfather.
Okay.
Who, when he passed away, they ended up giving him a minute of silence in Parliament. And the law that he had tried to shepherd through in the first place had been passed.
Crazy.
Yeah.
We just had a quick... rundown.
So who's from the Mauritius? Live podcast.
Richard's mom.
The mom side is
Mauritius. So my mom comes from that side, and my dad is British. So my mom is colonized by the British, and my old man is British. And so the family ends up in
Montreal. They met here in Montreal.
Yeah. And so on. I grew up here.
Very cool.
So
how did your dad's family end up in Montreal? No
they
idea.
Never came. My
they
dad
never came?
Came over. My father, after World War II, served as in a tank crew of a Sexton tank in Germany from 47 to 49, and when the Marshall Plan was rebuilding and all that kind of stuff. And
chances are with my grandfather.
And then in 49, going back to Britain, I mean, the country was, you know, literally in ruins. Europe was in ruins. And he said, I got to get a better life. So he got on this big ocean liner called the Lycia, and came over to Montreal.
He was like a reverse war bride.
Pardon me?
He said he was like a reverse war bride.
Yeah. My mom, you know, when my mom's family was exiled, you know, people in those days traveled by ocean liner. Mom arrived in Montreal. She on the Carinthia, which is another great luxury liner, which was floating in the dock of in the harbor of Hong Kong for up until the early 90s as a floating casino and hotel. But it was a different world back then.
Yeah,
you know?
My mom, that my grandfather, French Canadian, was like on like the first boat over to the war from that Canada sent, basically. Spent the whole time stationed out in Germany and whatever else like that, because he married my grandma, who was a British military nurse.
Yeah.
And so there was like a lot of, you know, cross mingling with British armed forces, with Canadian forces. Yeah. So got to know her, whatever. Married her. They lived over in Germany. He flew back to Montreal, or I don't know if he took a boat back or whatever he did to get back, to set them up first, because he had been gone since the early 40s. So he'd been not living here for almost a decade by the time he came, was done with Germany. And my mom came over on the boat and still has the big brown booster shot mark that everybody who took boats has. I don't know, your mom probably
has. I don't recall. I don't know. I'm just actually tell you the truth. I'm going to ask her that.
If she has an upper, it was, I don't know if it was more prominent on the kids because like the bruising or whatever was
it bigger. Shitty inoculations or?
Yeah, dude. It was like the fucking late 40s. It was like to do a transatlantic boat trip or whatever, you had to have your immunization.
Right.
And like to this day she has like a big mark and a ton of the kids from that era. I don't know about the generation that was a little bit older, because I think it may be like bruised and damaged like a kid's arm a little bit more than an adult's. But yeah, my mom like has the thing from being a.
And you know, and like, I mean, you were talking earlier about how you know, if that bomb had gone off, or no, if it was you had mentioned that bomb had gone off in London, you know, my old man would have been dead.
Yeah.
But I'm actually also thinking, you know, had my grandfather taken the ambassadorship in Washington, D.C., my parents would not have gotten married in Montreal and I would not be born.
Yeah, you'd been.
So it's really all those weird things that happened overseas were kind of crucial to, you know.
Hmm. And goodbye this existence. And goodbye this podcast classic, am I right?
That's right.
Am I right?
There you go.
For a geek audience, you know, it's like the end of The Watchmen, right?
Right.
The end of the. I don't know if you've seen The Watchmen or read The Watchmen and whatever. If you're gonna consume it, read it, the Alan Moore graphic novel. Right at the end, there's like a character who basically becomes omniscient and omnipotent and everything else like that. So human life means absolutely nothing to him, and he's like, his entire desire is to witness a miracle, because he's like, there are no miracles whatsoever. Everything is like fucking science, the planets, the everything. And the end of it is that his sort of like thing is that every human life is a miracle, because he's like, it's fucking like such an infinitely small chance that every one of us exists.
And what did we forget on this anecdote, Keith?
Spoiler alert. Thank you. Spoiler. You just ruined Watchmen for our.
Who the fuck hasn't read The Watchmen?
Dozens of listeners.
Hundreds, to be fair, and also it was
thousands. Come
thousands
on.
For this episode.
Well, right, because you're just gonna like link the shit out of this one, right, Richard?
Link it to everywhere. The Watchmen came out almost 20 years ago, Walter.
Now,
if you don't know Watchmen, you're an idiot. You should go read it.
Now, here's how I got to know you initially, and I didn't know you for the longest time. You were just a guy that I saw around a lot, and I wasn't sure who you were. I go to plays and stuff, reviewing the plays for the day job, and I'd see you around, and I'm like, "There's that guy again." Not entirely sure who he is, but I see him literally at everything. Yeah. So I have a practical question for you now. How many nights out of the week would you say you're at home doing nothing? Like watching TV or reading a book?
Sunday night.
Sunday night, that's it? That's that, and you it. Make a point of that?
I like it to be more. I have a 19-year-old brother, but when he was a kid, he used to spend every weekend at my place, basically from the ages of about 4 to about 14, 15. And weekends were always reserved for me and Sky. We either go tobogganing on Mount Royal or swimming at the Schubert Indoor Pool on the Main.
At which point we'd still see you at the Mount Tobogganing on Mount Royal.
But during that 10-year period, I would only go out during weeknights.
Right.
And so now sometimes I'll go out Friday and Saturday nights. But it's just part of the job, man.
Yeah.
You know, I used to go out a whole lot more. I used to drink a whole lot more. you know, it's now if I, you know, I drink a whole lot. It's kind of difficult to get to work.
But your social calendar, or what I perceive to be your social calendar, frightens me. Legitimately frightens me. Because, I
love going
through the social networks and whatnot, and just from seeing you at certain things. I mean, when I see someone at, like, everything that I go to, I assume that they're going to, like, three times the amount of things that I'm going to. And so it just freaks me out. Like, do you see, like, every play?
No, I don't see every play. But I'll tell you, in the last 3 or 4 weeks, let's say the last 21 days, I've probably been out 18.
Wow.
So a lot.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And, but it's also the season, you know.
And you were at the and I saw you were posting today about the opera gala. You were at the OSM gala.
Yeah. Well, I was on Sunday afternoon. I went to the 17th annual Opera de Montréal gala, which is it's always a cool event.
Is it?
Yeah, I mean, I've been going. Yeah, no, it is.
I know. It's an actual question. I'm not being
a
smartass.
I'm a big opera queen. I love opera. But it was the first time I'd seen it performed in the Maison Symphonique.
Right.
It's the second year it's been there. I was unable to go last year, but I'd seen it in the PDA for many, many years earlier. And so this was kind of fun. I love going. I love taking my mom to the opera. You know, when she grew up in Mauritius, one of the things that she loved to do, my grandfather, he owned racehorses and, you know, he was a big shot, like we were talking earlier.
Yeah.
He was a big shot lawyer and stuff like that. And he loved taking the family to the opera. When he took the kids, I don't mean like one or two kids, there were like 12 kids. And, you know, they had their own box and everything like that.
Oh, shit.
So I grew up in a house where opera was always, you know, part of the background.
Right.
And my dad, he was quite the opposite. He was a big jazz and blues lover, so... That's where I got the best of everything.
Right. Yeah.
But so I love taking my mom to the opera, and that's where we were on Sunday.
Very
it was
cool.
Great. It was terrific. It's fun getting dressed up, man. That's one of the things I don't like about a lot of people today is, you know, I love to go out. And sometimes I just like to go out like I am now, or scruffy in jeans or whatnot. Or sometimes I like to put on a suit and tie, or just a nice jacket and a tie and stuff. It's fun. And so the opera for me is one of those occasions where it's just kind of nice to, you know, just kind of throw on a splash of color and a nice tie and, you know.
I got to say, one of the looks I'm most familiar with of yours is the denim jacket. You do rock the denim jacket a lot. And I was out somewhere a couple months ago. I was actually in Toronto. And I really enjoy wearing jean jackets. They're just useful. And then somebody made a snooty remark about the fact that
How are they more useful than a regular jacket?
They just are.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, and somebody made a snooty
remark.
And
they got to be Levi's, man. I'm a Levi's fan.
Somebody made a snooty remark about my jean jacket. They're like, oh, what are jean jackets coming back in fashion? I'm like, when did they go out in fashion, sir? Yeah. When did they go out?
I have a question. One, just get your mic a little closer. You're just dropped off a little bit in the levels. Number two is I've always had the inclination that the opera could be a good time. The only one I've ever seen is the Nutcracker, and it's just...
It's not an opera.
It's not an opera.
Yeah,
no,
and
not at all.
The Nutcracker, Nutcracker, God bless the version that Les Grands Ballets Canadiens do, but I think it's a boring story.
But yeah, exactly.
You've got to go see these classic Italian operas where everybody dies.
That's
great. But, you know, like...
I don't mind the opera scenes in movies.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, where you see, like, a guy or a girl, like, singing, and you're like... I was like, I could get it.
Like in Batman Begins.
I was going to say Sergio Argento.
Sergio
Argento's opera.
An opera can be as gripping as Batman Begins. I kid you not. You look at I saw the opera Tosca for the first time last year. Absolutely gripping from beginning to end. And when you listen to it, you guys, if you're not opera aficionados or opera classical music lovers, you will recognize, I guarantee you, three or four of the songs in there.
Right.
Same thing with La Bohème and La Traviata. And again, a lot of these classic Italian operas are just so well known. And I know the stories are ridiculous. I mean, come on, you know. And they're so sexist and chauvinist and everything like that. And everybody always dies. But they're fantastic.
It's
oh, my
kind
God.
Of like the, I came into a room, and because the person just left, I committed suicide because I missed them. Like,
yeah.
Bring it full circle. I mean, Bugs, Richard Bugs Burnett, my opera knowledge obviously comes from the classic Warner Brothers shorts and the Bugs Bunny.
Right.
Yeah. And Figaro, The Marriage of Figaro and all that, and Wagner. The initial exposure is from Bugs Bunny.
Yeah, and if you're a fan of Wagner's, if you're listening to Wagner, I can understand why you hate opera, because Wagner is really, I don't know how you say it in English.
Plotting?
C'est très lugubre. And it's really heavy, and the production Opera de Montréal had the Flying Dutchman here earlier this month. Oh my God! Can somebody kill me now, please? Jesus Christ! Okay, the woman at the end of the Flying Dutchman, the heroine, is supposed to commit suicide, but instead of being in control of her own death, the guy that she dumps shoots her with a gun on stage. It's kind of like, you can't fuck around with opera like that. You know,
clearly we need to go to the opera.
Yeah,
well, we need to exactly. We need to, you need to recommend an opera to us. We'll go the three of us.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Yeah. Yeah. If I was gonna go to the opera with anybody, honestly, Richard, exactly. I'd
like so when the guy pulls out the gun, you're being like, they're fucking it up. She's supposed to kill herself.
I remember I went to go see Les Ballets Trocadero de Monte Carlo, which is basically a bunch of drag queen ballet dancers from New York. And they were playing at Montreal's Place des Arts, Salle for Peltier, and everybody sat down. I was like second or third row center stage. It was wonderful. And then you could hear this big gasp in the theater, and 3,000 heads turned. And who walked out onto one of the balconies but one of my great buddies, Luc Provost, a.k.a. Montreal drag queen, Mado Lamotte. And he was there with another drag queen, and they were dressed, decked out like Marie Antoinette with the big dress and the hair and everything. And they stole the show. It was fantastic. Anyway.
Speaking
love an entrance.
Of drag queens.
Speaking of drag queens, where is this going?
No. In our pre-interview, we had Plastic Patrick.
Oh, yeah.
I don't consider Patrick to be a drag queen. He's an androgyne club kid.
Yeah, exactly. That's
and he's a...
So is Keith, kind of, a little bit.
Was, formerly.
Yeah.
No, I was actually having a conversation with one of the former stars of the Montreal Roller Derby League, who was just like, they're like, Patrick is like a beautiful human being.
Yeah.
You're like, you don't really... It's not not a female, not fully male, either direction. Not fully a drag queen. Fair enough.
Yeah,
however,
go ahead.
When he was answering his best time ever question that happens at the end of the show, he talked about sharing the stage with Cyndi Lauper, which you apparently there's more to the story.
And you're laying claim to hooking this up.
You're like, I made this happen.
This happened. I'll tell you what. It was we put Cyndi Lauper on the cover. She was touring what album? It was an album of cover songs, and I forgot what it was. The album was called At Last.
Okay.
And, and it was about 2004, maybe 2005, around there. And she was playing Metropolis. Anyway, the ticket sales were tanking, you know, and our plan A and plan B cover stories had fallen through. I think Cyndi was our plan C or plan D. Finally, at the last minute, my
sorry,
editor
Cyndi.
Comes up to me and says, hey, man, I had a Sunday afternoon phoner scheduled with Cyndi at around 4 o'clock. And he said, is it a sure thing? I said, yeah, absolutely. So anyway, 4 o'clock Sunday. She says, okay, you got the covers. 4 o'clock Sunday rolls around. Cyndi calls me up. She says, listen, man, my previous interview, I haven't gotten through the list, blah, blah, blah. I'm dragging on time here. Can I call you back at 6? I said, yeah, I'm not going anywhere. No problem. Now, if you've seen Cyndi Lauper on Donald Trump's That Shit for Brains fucking TV show, The Apprentice, and you saw how, you know, she just never shuts up, let me tell you, it's true in real life. This woman just yapped on at 100 miles an hour, and you're like, what? Anyway, lovely woman, but anyway, she yaps forever. Anyway, so she calls me at 6 o'clock, and what was supposed to be a 15-minute interview turned into like an hour and a half.
Nice.
And
guys, we need 10 pages.
And I remember I said to her, I said, listen, you know, you're touring this album of covers. I said, I know this band in Montreal. It's a bunch of drag queens who do the most lascivious, nastiest punk rock cover of Shebop I've ever heard. And I said, every time they do a show in Montreal, the place is full of drag queens and strippers. And I said, the lead singer's name is Plastic Patrick. So Cyndi goes to me. She goes, Plastic Patrick? Oh, my God, what a fabulous name. And I said, well, I happen to know Patrick. She goes, do you think they want to come on stage and do an encore with me? I said, well, I happen to know Patrick. She said, okay, blah. So then we set it up, blah, blah, blah. And they were supposed to send out a CD to her management out in New York. So I call up Patrick at his day job. And, of course, he happens to be in frickin' Vegas. So I called up about a dozen hotels on the Vegas Strip looking for Patrick, and I finally found his room. He wasn't there, and I left a message. I said, motherfucker, you got to get your management, I think it was Alan Shipp at the time, you got to get him to send it to, this is the person in New York, boom, 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 boom. And then I go to the show at Metropolis, and without fully knowing if they'd connected or what, and who gets called out on stage for the encores but Patrick's band 1976. So they do La Vie en Rose together. And they did, I think they did Shebop. And then afterwards, Martha Wainwright came on stage and joined them to do Girls Just Want to Have Fun. And and because the show ended up selling out and the record company did then what they never do anymore, they said, wow, you want to come backstage and meet Cyndi? Thank you, thank you, thank you. I said, sure, why not? So I go backstage. I'm introduced to Cyndi. And In my story, I'd written, well, you know, she had had some very difficult years. She had gotten dumped by a record label and basically survived on the gay pride circuit. And she turns to me, she goes, and screamed at me at the top of her, she goes, I'm not getting dumped by my record label, right? And I'm standing there, and I was like, what am I supposed to say, right? So I was like, blah, blah, blah. So I, the only thing that I could do was I said, I'm sorry. So she calmed her down. She put me aside. She said, okay, you wait here. And then she continued to meet and greet everybody else on our grass, take pictures, whatever it is. And then afterwards, we had a little chat, and she turned out to be quite nice.
Sorry, that screech was, I just got dumped by my record label?
I know. She did. I did not get dumped.
I did not get dumped
by
my record.
I did not get dumped.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she dumped them, for the record. Was that?
Well,
was that?
I think she got dumped by her record.
Cyndi Lauper, long-time listener to the show.
I think it's pretty amazing that we have a guest that's corroborating the anecdote of another guest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're piecing it together. Eventually, we'll get Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the ultimate goal.
She's going to be like, I played in Montreal when?
Yeah, exactly. When exactly?
But I spoke with her, a couple of years ago. I've interviewed her many times. And last time, I guess, I don't know, it was 2010 or 11 or something, and when she played at the Montreal Jazz Fest. And, I get her on the phone, and at the time she was working hard to open up the True Colors residence for LGBT homeless youth in New York City.
Right.
Gay youth. And she'd had the True Colors tour across North America, and all the a good chunk of the money is raised at all the shows would go to fund this thing. And so, and she wanted to, and I remember one of her best friends who had passed away from AIDS, it was his dream to open this thing. And so she said, well, you know, I'll do it. And of course, it happened last year. I got her on the phone, and she was crying as she was telling me the story. And then just to try to change the subject, kind of pick it up, right. I said, hey, man, but do you remember the night you were in Montreal, blah, 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 with Plastic Patrick and everything, blah, blah. I said, it was such a great time. And she goes to me, she goes, Richard, what, you think I got Alzheimer's or something?
It's good. So she does remember.
She does remember.
That's awesome.
Worst interview ever.
The worst interview?
Because I'm sure you got a lot of best. What's the worst?
Oh, God. There's so many. I can't even.
Really?
Oh,
I love just while you think, while you meditate on that answer. Well, I won't say the name of the guy, but I love Walter's story where you had like a phone interview that just was like way south. And then like at the end, you were just sort of like.
Oh, yeah.
Like you just like apologized or whatever. And then the guy like opened up and was like, yeah, I don't know, man. I'm just having like a shitty day or whatever. Yeah. It was just like. Yeah, like, and you
phoners are always weird, though, right? Because you can't really read the like yeah. the mood.
But he
of the
he played it for me, and it was like the driest, shittiest answers of a guy. Who
no,
just,
I'll
like,
say it. He's not going to hear it. You know, Patton Oswalt, the comic.
Patton Oswalt, the comedian.
Yep. I had to, and it was set up by the festival by the JFL. So they're like, you should talk to Patton Oswalt. I'm like, all right.
He was doing the keynote.
Sounds
too.
Good, but I got like an hour's notice beforehand because it wasn't even supposed to happen, and I think it was a mistake. And then I talked to him, and he wasn't cooperative. And then at the end, I was just like, look, I'm sorry, man. Like I had minimal preparation. He's like, oh no, it's okay. He's like, this whole thing is shitty anyway. Like,
this whole situation.
It's just the whole situation. Like,
I didn't know you were talking to me until like a couple of minutes ago.
So like a shitty interview.
Well,
shitty.
I'll tell you, there are a lot of shitty ones, but the non-shitty ones are actually more fun. I got the last ever sit-down interview with James Brown.
Ooh, no
just
shit.
A few days before he passed away. And I remember...
Face-to-face?
Actually, on the phone.
Okay.
On the phone. And I had to check this out with his publicist, Vicky Mazzeppi, in New York. I was the last person... I was the last journalist he spoke with. And I had... They had to vet all of my questions. I don't normally like
Who's
doing
they?
That. I would have
his
to.
People.
I had to send his people. I
well, yeah,
send
no,
his
just,
people
yeah.
a list of like the 20 questions I'm going to ask. So basically,
that's rough. Yeah,
I hate doing that, but you know what? It's James fucking
Brown. It's James
Brown.
Yeah, yeah.
So
you make exceptions.
So basically, I couldn't ask him any questions about anything to do with the law. Could not ask him any questions about being black. Or being a civil rights icon or anything like that. Right?
Why?
I know. So I got him on the phone. I'm like, what the hell am I going to talk to him about? So we start talking about him being a lefty. He wanted to be a baseball pitcher, but he could, in the end, an injury prevented him from becoming a baseball. His favorite baseball player was Jackie Robinson, who got his pro start as a baseball pro baseball player with the Montreal Royals in 1946. Says, "Yeah, I remember, man." And so we got into that, which led us right into black politics and civil rights and so on and so this and that until he was asking me questions, man. He says, "So where are you from, son? Yeah, I know you're not a white boy." Stuff like this, right? And so here I was. He was interviewing me. It was great. So, and at the end, I just remember asking him, "So what does God think of The Godfather?" And he goes to me, he goes, "He's a producer. I'm just the director." And then 3 days later, he was dead.
Yeah, and I know, and he was, and there was, and he had a concert schedule.
Christmas Day, in fact.
He had a concert schedule in Montreal, like a few months down the road.
Yeah, a few days after that, actually, the first week of January.
Yeah.
He died December 25th, I think it was 2006.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he had concerts scheduled in Montreal, Quebec City, and Ottawa the first week of January.
And that was the whole unfortunate business of his remains. And
the opposite thing happened to Joe Strummer. I was so pissed. Joe Strummer died a few weeks after the Mescaleros played in Montreal, and I was like a fucking broke student and like had a list of concerts, and that one like didn't make the list, and I was like, catch him next time. Two 3 weeks after the Mescaleros played in Montreal, Joe Strummer died.
Congenital heart failure.
I was like, what the fuck? Yeah. What the actual fuck?
But so, did you get to see Joe in Montreal?
I've never seen Joe Strummer. I never will. And it was like, I was... That was that year where not everybody died, but there was
and
like
that's
a big...
that's a great venue. Spectrum was, you know, it's sad to see that place go.
Yeah, I like Spectrum like tons more than my.
There were a lot of great venues along St. Catherine, you know, the Strip. But even like there's a great black club. It was the Apollo of Montreal. It was the Esquire Show Bar on the corner of St. Catherine and Stanley. Okay. It was almost across the street from Chez Paris, and that itself before it became a strip bar. Was one of these vaudeville show bars, you know, back when Frank Sinatra, it was owned by, I believe the guy's name was Shipman. He was at one time, he was known as a Montrealer. He owned two illegal casinos in Montreal, one up by Queen Mary and DeCary.
Not one, but two.
one out in the South Shore, I believe in Greenfield Park or St. Lambert. Anyway, he was reputed to be the biggest gambler in North America. And he owned Chez Paris at the time.
Right.
And when I mean he was the biggest gambler in North America, I mean, I think William Weintraub writes about him as spending upwards in the day of $500,000 in gambling per year.
Well, there you go.
Arnold Rothstein.
Yeah, and like, yeah, there you go.
On par with Arnold Rothstein.
Yeah. So anyway, he owned Chez Paris, and he hired Frank Sinatra to sing there. I don't know for how many weeks, and Frank held court. That whole strip was absolutely amazing, and the Spectrum was at the very very tail end of that. It used to be the Club Montreal at first,
right.
And in fact, actually, I went to go see Johnny Rotten from.
Public Image Limited. From Sex Pistols.
From Sex Pistols. He was playing recently at Corona. I was standing outside smoking a cigarette. Yes, people, I still smoke. Shut up. And I was.
That's it, people.
For the record, neither of us would tell. We're disapproving of the cigarette, of the cigarette thing. We took that all in phase.
I'm standing outside smoking a cigarette. Who walks in but Andre Menard, who's the guy from the Jazz Fest?
Right.
And he goes, I'm here to go backstage to go meet up with Johnny Rotten, because the Sex Pistols, Johnny, I think it was, I don't know if it was the Sex Pistols in 82. He said they were the first band to ever play. I think it might have been PIL.
Might have been Public Image Limited.
It had to be PIL.
Yeah.
82?
Was it not?
I think so.
I don't remember, man. It's got to be PIL.
We'll fact check this after the fact.
Yeah, we'll check it. But it's close. It's really, really close. Yeah.
Anyway, so Johnny was the guy that was on stage at the Spectrum, the very first band when it went from Club Montreal to the Spectrum.
Right.
And I remember my first time in a joint was 80... I can't remember if it was... when Tina Turner had... What's Love Got to Do with It, Went Number One. I don't know if it was September 83 or September 84. But she did two shows.
Like, was not born. I'm like, 4 months old.
She did two shows. A 7 o'clock show and a 10 o'clock show. I saw the 7 o'clock show. She found out backstage, it was a Thursday night, that What's Love Got to Do with It was going to be number one on Sunday on the Billboard Hot 100. And so she came out on stage. I'll never forget it as long as I live. And she had the band do ZZ Top's Legs. And she just basically, she tore down, shredded the place. And... Then the 10 o'clock show rolls around, and the fire department raided the Spectrum because the building didn't meet any of the fire code. It was violating all the fire code violations, and so they told Tina Turner to get off stage. But I miss that venue, man. That was a great rock and roll venue.
Oh, we're talking about which location Spectrum. Now? Upon? Yeah, no, but like one at the upon
Spectrum on the corner of Blurry and
yeah.
St. Catherine.
Yeah. Shall we jump into five question time? Five question time.
So five questions is where we ask the same three questions of all the guests. Then our previous guests asked a question to you without knowing that it was
that
you.
It was going
to
be you.
And then the fifth question is you're actually asking a question.
Carte blanche.
Carte blanche to the guest in the future, who we don't know who it's going to be.
Not a clue.
Not a clue.
Okay.
Walter, do you want to take a crack at it?
Sure.
All right, go. First question.
First.
I'll correct you if you're wrong.
Question, and I always screw up on the order, but first question, favorite drink.
Favorite drink?
Wrong. But we'll do it.
We'll do it that way?
We'll do it that
doesn't
way.
Doesn't matter. Favorite drink. Non-alcoholic or alcoholic.
Or
doesn't matter. Alcoholic or non-alcoholic.
We had a professional bartender on who gave all three, which he gave his favorite spirit, he gave his favorite beer, and he gave his favorite non-alcoholic. So you can.
So you could do one.
You could do
or
one
two,
or many
or three.
If you have situational favorites,
yeah. I love ice cold milk. I gotta say, I'm a big milk drinker. I can drink a couple of liters of milk a day.
Good to know.
Easy. In a party or dinner situation, I like a nice cold white wine. A Chardonnay is nice, but I'm particularly partial to double vodkas on the rocks and beer chasers.
I would like to draw attention to the fact that in the most, like, I drink one drink at a time, and I find that the hard liquor with the beer chaser, which Richard's actually been enjoying during this podcast, is amazing. Like, as a concept of, like...
Oh, is that what you're drinking? Is that vodka?
Yeah.
With the lime?
Okay. Double vodka?
I assumed it was a G&T because of the lime, but... Right.
And the amount of liquor was because it was a double.
What kind of vodka? what brand? What brand vodka?
I have no idea what they got behind the bar. I think it was Smirnoff.
If you had your
choice? If I have a choice? Oh, anything. Well, you know what? Actually, some of the Canadian vodka is not bad. The Polarice is pretty good.
Really?
Yeah, I don't mind it.
Interesting.
And the Iceberg or whatever, that Iceberg Titanic thing looking at me. I don't think that shit. but, I mean, you know, Grey Goose. I mean, nothing compares to Grey Goose.
All right.
You know, that's like, it's like butter.
That's fair.
It just goes down.
Now, Keith, because I've always screwed up the order of the questions, why don't you just handle the rest?
Right. But anyway, just to wrap up my point, I think that Walter, you and I both need to start drinking stiff alcohol on the rocks.
I have no problem with
this. With the beer chaser.
Whatsoever.
It's going to be our thing.
not an issue.
You're a Scotch drinker?
Scotch, whiskey, whatever.
I can drink bourbon.
I like bourbon. I've recently been acquiring a bourbon taste. So,
I can drink gin. I can drink straight gin.
Yeah, I can't do that.
I remember one night I was Halloween night in New Orleans a couple years ago. I was drinking absinthe as my buddy Vinny. He's opening my mouth and going...
Where did I just read this story? Where did you just reveal this recently?
It might have been a quick post on Facebook.
I just read something about you drinking absinthe in New Orleans.
And I tripped and I slid.
Starry Night.
Yeah.
Because you were making reference to Starry Night.
Yes. Oscar Wilde's got this thing about how the stars look so bright from
when
your life is down in the dumps. And so I took it a step further. I said, well, when you're in the stars look brighter when you're actually in the gutter. And I knew this for a fact because I was out of it, I tripped and fell. I practically fell underneath a cop's horse on bourbon, right? And I'm looking up and I'm going, just, please don't shit on me. But anyway.
God. It was half view of stars, half view of horse. Asshole.
And as I went down, I'm contorting my body because I didn't want to hit my elbows or my knees because I would have scraped them.
Right.
It's Halloween, but it's hot as hell in NOLA, right?
And so I
landed on my thigh, on my side here. And I remember there's this bathhouse on Toulouse Street in the French Quarter that that Vince calls Toulouse Street that I was going to go to. But when I woke up the next morning with a bruise the size of the African continent on the side of my body, there's no fucking way I'm going to no sauna looking like this. But anyway, that was from drinking too much absinthe. I literally slid into the gutter.
Nice. That was the most colorful answer to most. The best drink.
Favorite drink,
I think.
Your favorite childhood toy, plaything, thing that you enjoyed from your childhood. We've had in the past, like, hockey stick and whatever, puck, and weird cape.
I was never a hockey player.
Doesn't need to be a toy. Just yeah, a thing like that you...
I had figure skates. They were black. I remember I spray painted them black because I got picked on at the rink. But I always wanted to be a figure skater, but I did not become one. But the thing I still have from my youth is my teddy bear.
Teddy bear? You have one of those old school, like, this is my teddy
bear.
Yeah,
it's got like fucking 10 layers of clothing and, you know, it's stitched up together so it doesn't fall apart. And there you go.
Cool. I like it.
It's a good answer.
Dose. Trade. Classic.
And its name is Teddy, of course. Go for it.
There you go.
Teddy.
Numero three is, wait, I know this. I know this.
This is the best time ever question.
Best time ever.
Most fun you ever had. Best time ever.
Oh, God, guys, come on.
This is where we originally got the Cyndi Lauper.
This is where the Cyndi Lauper. For Plastic Patrick, you gave Plastic Patrick his best time
his
ever.
Best time ever. Are you proud
best
of that?
Best time ever.
Like, that's you were responsible for that. Is what you.
Well, I can't tell you just one. I've had a spectacularly good time over the years. I've woken up in some crazy places. You know, and some not so nice places. I used to hustle. I used to be, when I ran out of money backpacking across Australia, I sold my ass. That could be fun sometimes.
That doesn't
but,
sound like the
you
best
know,
time
but,
ever
but,
at all.
But I know. Well, maybe not for you.
Well,
hey, well, it wasn't for me, but I'll tell you.
But I'll take the situation that led
yeah, yeah,
to
yeah.
it.
I remember I knew it was time to come back to Canada. I was in this bar. It was Rex's. It was on Oxford Street in the Darlinghurst district of Sydney. It was Rex's bar and Bottoms Up. I kid you not, it was Bottoms Up. And there was this 80-year-old man at the bar.
The Australians have such a direct, to the point, like no like double entendre, no innuendo. Bottoms Up. Go
dude,
there.
It was $20 for a blowjob, except he was 80 years old. And I went to the can. Pre-cell phone days. So I went to the men's can. I pretended to be talking on the phone. And I was like, just wanted to look like I was doing something as I was thinking it through. And then I walked right out of the place, and I booked a flight back to Canada. I just couldn't do it anymore.
Whoa. But it's the opposite.
But anyway, that
would be my best time.
Best time ever.
So that was.
And
that
you
was
just and you just highlighted a personal hell.
is blowing this 80-year-old guy $20 to make my trip last a little longer something I can do?
Oh, God. I don't know, man. It's like, you know, I remember one time. Oh, goodness. I don't have just one great time, but I, there are a lot of fun moments. I tell you, the first time I saw B.B. King was 1983. Plaza Star. My dad brought me to go see him. I was 15 years old. And at the time, Dudu Boissel, who's a friend of mine, used to own Rising Sun. And yeah. At the time, the house band was a Stephen Barry Blues Band, who got their start at the Esquire Show Bar on Stanley. But they were the house band for 3 years, and they were the backup band for everybody from John Lee Hooker to Big Mama Thornton, who was performing across the street the night I saw B.B. King at the Rising Sun. Dudu comes across the street with Big Mama, who knew B.B. King back from the 1940s and early 50s. So he brings her up on stage, and I'll never forget her coming on stage with her walker, right? And she blew everybody off the stage. She died just a few months later, I think of it at the age of 55 or 58 from alcoholism. But after that show, B.B. King went across the street with his band and James Cotton and stuff, and they played till 4 o'clock in the morning. And Dudu goes to me, he goes, before they left, he peeled out his wallet and gave everybody $100. So 25 years later, I go see B.B. King, except this time, instead of my dad taking me, I take my dad. And we managed to get, at this time now, my dad's practically the one with the walker. He's got a cane. And we're standing outside his bus, and one of the security cortege comes out and says, sir, would you like to go in the bus and sit down? I said, Dad, come on, let's go. In the bus.
Yeah.
So he sits down, whatever it is, while everybody else waits outside the bus. Mr. King is getting changed in the back of the bus. Finally, the drapes open. You're welcome to come back into the inner sanctum.
Right.
So Dad goes back there with his cane, and he's the same age as Mr. King. And I remember Mr. B.B. King tapping the seat next to me. He says, come sit next to me here. Sit here next to me, young man. And the two of them started shooting shit about the blues and stuff like that. And I was just like, I didn't exist. And it was wonderful. I got a lot of photos. And then I thanked Mr. King. I said, Mr. King, he's the man that introduced you to your music in this very venue 25 years earlier. And it was what makes it a great story is my father brought me to see him 25 yeah. years earlier, and now, 25 years later, I got to actually introduce him to B.B. King, who was met him many times, great guy, wonderful guy, and I'll just tell you my last thing about Mr. King. I got to say, he said about Elvis Presley, I liked Elvis because he called me sir.
Have you ever pitched that to the Hallmark Network? That whole story, that whole thing, the life and times of B.B. King on the Hallmark Network, maybe around Christmas. I think that'd be a lovely anecdote. Like, I think
you ever considered traveling back in time to talk to Norman Rockwell to make that anecdote a painting?
That's
heartwarming.
That really was. Like, my heart literally feels warm. Now we get into less heartwarming territory.
No, this isn't that.
Oh, no. This is my lady friend, Catherine.
This is not.
You guys have met briefly.
This is our question, the agreed upon question that came from B movie star, B movie director. B movie star, John
Christian
Fallon.
Christian Viel, yeah.
And B movie director,
John Fallon.
No, Christian Viel. We said the reverse.
Yeah.
We fucked it up. Anyhow, Did you have a really eloquent wording for it?
Yeah, well, not really, not so much. But it was an interesting question. It was, what was the most embarrassing situation you've ever found yourself in that you somehow got your way out of?
Came out smelling like
while like saving face,
or so, potentially, you know, an embarrassing situation that never actually became embarrassing, like a potentially embarrassing situation that you fucking turned on its head and came out smelling like roses. It's a rough question.
But you know what? I know it's happened to me before. I mean, the worst thing, you know, is not to get a story accurate. You know, today on the internet, if you get something wrong, you can instantly correct it on the net.
Right.
And put a little correction notice at the bottom saying this was updated or adjusted for this fact, blah, 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 you know.
Not so easy, like 15 years ago.
In the print days, you know, especially when you're an alt-weekly, like the Mirror of the Hour, you know, that mistake that you committed would be on the newsstands for a whole fucking week.
Yeah.
And there was no way you could, you know, everybody, you know, it's like even once you caught it, there's nothing you could do about it till so many days later.
Essentially, the world I still live in.
You rent one of those old-timey cars with, like, the bullhorns on top and driving, being like, page 7 has an error. Is there one situation where you, like, particularly...
Did you fall into that trap, or...?
I can't tell you that I have not made mistakes. Of course, I've made a few mistakes in my career, but I can't. To be honest with you, right now, I can't think off the top of my head of a time where I was just so embarrassed and I got out of it.
Let's put it this way: was there anybody ever profiled that you were after the profile was published that you were afraid to encounter?
Well, you know, I did a cover story once of the murderer, Danny McElwain. And funny enough, Danny McElwain used to be a hustler. And he murdered Warren Ealing, the reverend that used to be at the church on the corner of Bishop and St. Catherine Street.
Okay.
On the northwest corner.
Sure, yeah.
He liked getting his dick sucked by guys.
All right.
And so he would pay... Danny McElwain, this hustler, money or crack cocaine to suck his dick.
Fair enough.
One night, Danny McElwain was convicted of murdering Warren Ealing and went to jail. It took me about 18 months to get inside the prison, Bordeaux. But I went in with a photographer. We did a cover story. And I had made a promise to his lawyer, Sal Massia, that we would... put an appropriate cover photo on the cover, but we had trouble finding an appropriate cover. It wasn't my choice. Our editor-in-chief at the time was Peter Scowen, who's now, I believe, over at the Globe and Mail. Peter Scowen, by the way, always used to say, being manager of the Hour is like being editor-in-chief of the Hour is like being the manager of the Who. And he chose a picture of McElwain, I think, in cuffs, being led either into court or into prison.
Right.
And... visually, we put, like, you know, the crosshairs of a camera or a gun right on McElwain. When that was published, I started getting phone calls, right? And it was not my choice. It was
from
not
whom?
My fault. From Sal Massia, from saying, what the fuck is this kind of cover? How is this appropriate?
Yeah.
And, you know, and here I was. I had said, you know, we weren't going to sensationalize it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, people that you write about, unfortunately, have a thin skin, and it happens. But it was one of those moments where I did not feel comfortable in my skin, and I was getting it from all sides. The gay community at that point was really upset with me for portraying them as zealots. I was just, you know, I just didn't want to get a phone call from Danny in prison going, "When I come out!"
And did it eventually sort of...
And then it just kind of died off. But I'll tell you, I remember talking to Nick Offenbar. Bring it full circle. Here we are in Grumpy's. In fact, I believe it was in this bar. He told me this. I can't believe this shit, because this is 1997. And... I was flipping out, or it might have been at Ziggy's, but anyway.
Nope, it was at
Grumpy's. No, it was here.
It was here.
It was definitely here.
It was definitely here.
I was here as well. I was there too.
It was here.
I was 11.
And I go to Nick. I go, "Dude, man, I'm getting it from all sides." And the thing is, Nick inherited the dead priest's cat, Warren Ealing's cat. He inherited the cat.
How the fuck did that happen?
I don't know how the fuck that happened. But
there's a Montreal that we need to travel back in time and live in.
And Nick goes to me, you know, my lead was kind of like, Warren Ealing leaned over to Danny McElwain and said, he was taking from his crack pipe, "You want to suck my dick?" So Nick goes to me, goes, "Wow, that's like one of the greatest leads of all time. Fuck what everybody says. You're doing your job when everybody hates your guts." So, you know, Nick was there. I was flipping out at the time, man. You know, I was really kind of nervous. I'll tell you another story.
Sure.
Shit.
Go for it. That story is... fucking tops as it is.
Yeah, that beats the clown.
2004, this Jamaican dancehall singer called Sizzla, SAZZLA, from Kingston.
As you would spell Sizzla.
He was one of the singers of very rabidly anti-gay songs, and a lot of gay activists wanted to stop him from coming into Canada because under the hate speech provisions of the Criminal Code of Canada. I ended up getting an interview with him while he was in Canada, which was a mistake on his part, where he told me, "Well, we must burn the Batman. We must put them on fire because this is Sodom and Gomorrah must go, blah, 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 blah." Right. And, of course, when he said this on Canadian soil, then he contravened the hate crimes legislation. So I wrote this, and it was our cover story. This thing went viral before viral existed, really.
Before that was even a possibility.
And, I remember it was on the CTV National News as their lead story and stuff, and I was being hounded by Music Plus. And I remember one of the disc jockeys over at Shum called it Batty Gate, and it was just absolutely insane. They had to call up press conferences. I got all my press privileges revoked by the promoter. Then it started in Australia and Jamaica. They were writing op-eds about me, going, "This guy is a liar," and they called it homophobia as opposed to homophobia because I was a homosexual who was lying about Sizzla. Mm-hmm. And it just spiraled out of control, and I thought I was going to lose my job. It was really, really at the time.
Well,
it was scary. I ended up having to sign affidavits saying that he actually said this to me on Canadian soil.
Yeah.
So that these activists, and then all of a sudden I became part of the story, which is I did not want that at all.
I just printed what he said. That's all I did.
You know. And so I ended up signing these affidavits and stuff like that. In the end, the show ended up going on, and it's the aftermath of that is, of course, nobody in the dancehall community forgets this thing, and but I don't give a shit. Fuck him. But you know, this guy's an asshole. He's a fucking asshole. Yeah. Fuck him too. But at the time, I tell you, I'll be honest with you. I was really, really nervous and really, really scared, and I thought I was going to lose my job. No,
but you didn't.
But I didn't.
Good. Fifth question, Walter.
Now here's the exciting part, where you get to formulate whatever question you want, anything, literally anything, and from
G to X rated.
Yeah, from G to X rated, and that will be the next question for our next guest, whether that be a nun or a streetwalker.
All right.
We have yet to interview a hobo.
We've yet to interview a hobo.
Just the one question.
One question?
One question. We might get to interview a hobo.
Hollywood still hasn't come on.
Hollywood has not.
You know Hollywood?
There's one
rock star
you could fuck. Who would it be and why?
Well, there you go.
One rock star who could fuck could that's, be one. Could you write this down, Walter?
Yeah. Well, all
write
right.
This down
I'm writing
so we
it
don't
down.
Have...
Writing it. You see me
no,
writing
he's
it?
Not doing it. Keith, we have this issue where before every episode we need to go back and listen to the other episode because no one takes any formal record of these questions.
Sorry, did you say why and how?
If there's one rock star you would like to fuck, who and why?
Oh.
I'm gonna.
How would have been weird.
I'm gonna.
How? Yeah. Who,
I was
why,
like, I'm
why,
gonna
how.
Add how.
Yeah, whether that's really how. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. Exactly.
How
and how.
Not why. Just how.
Yeah. Exactly. How.
Well, this has been a whole shit ton of fun.
Yeah, it is. We're gonna. So it basically wraps it up. So if we, I guess we can remind everybody what Richard does.
And are you sure there's nothing you'd like to plug?
There's a whole bag
listen, you know, you can find me. I'm blogging full time over the MontrealGazette.com.
There you go.
It's the Pop Tart blog.
There's
you know,
thing.
There
two
are
things.
There are you know, since the hour in the mirror of clothes, and people are wondering where they can get their fix of alternative news and alternative culture. You know, there is the there's Cult Montreal on,
sure.
on the web.
Yeah.
There is also you do great work, I think, over at the Suburban. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
And but also when it comes to theater, I would go to. The Charlebois Post, Charlebois Post Montreal, the Charlebois Post Canada.
Yes.
They're the theater authority quite now, quite
absolutely.
Frankly, right now.
Yeah.
And Pop Tart, I do on the Montreal Gazette website. And it's I'm talking about all the stuff that you normally would not see in a mainstream publication. And we're talking about strippers and gay stuff and tranny stuff and rock and roll, and
so it's
all the good stuff.
A little bit. So if you're a little bit of $3 bill, like I guess.
Yeah,
it can't be. It's not the same.
Listen, you know, I can't cuss and swear and be
yeah,
as
exactly.
outrageous as I could be over there.
I don't know, I check it out every once in a while, and I don't know. Like you get away with a little.
But
bit.
I get away with yeah. a lot, and the Gazette loves me. So
yeah.
And I love the Gazette for publishing me. So thanks to them. You can find me if you go to the blog section on MontrealGazette.com or just Google Richard Burnett Pop Tart and you'll fall right on the link.
Richard, thank you so much.
We'll
thank
put,
you guys.
Put the links and everything. Do you
have
Twitter?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Twitter? At Bugs Burnett.
There you go.
At Bugs Burnett. Full circle. This was Go Plug Yourself episode 25. I'm
episode 25. I'm Keith. I'm Walter.
You're Walter.
I'm not Keith. I'm
and
Walter.
If I were to plug myself, I'd have my pants at my ankles right
hey now.
Hey now.
Come on.
Richard Burnett, everybody. Thanks
thank
a lot
you so
for
much.
Thanks for coming on. That motherfucker goes to you as a dog, an animal, is he a little motherfucker? I guess not, they need a fucker. Is he getting wood? You're dead, and fucking with a leg and sick of food. What do you need to get for? Hey, I'm carrying your fucking DMI. Is he a hey everyone, it's me again, wasting your time at the end of the podcast where it doesn't matter anyways. Look, if you're a fan of the show and the site in general, please take the time to like us on Facebook. We are number9to5dotcc, 9to5.cc on Facebook. And also follow us on Twitter. We're @number9to5cc on Twitter. So and also be sure to check back on the site for something on Mondays, probably. We have Zombies and Loathing After the Bomb usually on Tuesdays. We have a new comic in 9to5 Illustrated every Wednesday, a new podcast every week, usually on Thursday. It's either going to be a 9ES or a Go Plug Yourselves. And on Fridays, we have Fine Arts with either Sophie and Scott. And, you know, maybe John will even contribute one of his mega articles at some point, too. You can only hope. All right, thanks.
9to5.cc. We're not working. Why should you? Thanks for listening.